Hey, welcome back to a brand new episode of The Film Show. Three new films up for discussion today. I'll be talking about Michael Winterbottom's new movie Greed with Steve Coogan. I'll be talking about Underwater, a new kind of like Abyss alien hybrid with Kristen Stewart. And I'll be talking about Emma, the new adaptation of Jane Austen's great novel, obviously. And, I mean, what else is there to talk about other than Parasite won the Oscar? And now, a couple of things I want to cover. Like, did I think that was going to happen? No, not a chance. Did I think it might happen as the evening rolled on? Because I did watch it because I was asked to go on the television to talk about it the next day. So I thought it was important to... Because the last time I was asked to go on the television to talk about it was when they announced La La Land as the winner instead of Moonlight by mistake. So it seems to be any time I watch the Oscars in that capacity, something different happens. But did I think it was going to win at the start of the evening? No, I thought 1917 was nailed on to win. I mean, it was a pretty boring Oscars in regards all the acting decision. You know, it was just all dead in the water before you got going because the same people have won absolutely everything throughout the entire procedure. But, the entire awards season, if you like. So none of that was interesting or, it was great to see... what's her name? Zellweger delivered one of the worst, most horrific speeches in Oscar's history, where you could just see the panic in her face. It was quite, but for someone who is like, you know, a world-renowned actress, you would think that going up and putting a performance right there and then would be quite easy, but clearly not. So all that was pretty drab about it, but once you saw them win script, and then when he won director, you got a sense of like something way different is going on here, you know, something outside of the normal. So when it came to Best Film, I was sitting there with Jess and I was like, it could win. Like I could see it winning now, and it did. And I'm not trying to make out that I was come out with some deep understanding of logic of the award season there at all, but it did seem that the momentum is a key thing in Oscars running up to it. And during the ceremony, you can feel momentum. That's why it's so weird when you get random winners like Chicago and Crash and so forth. Like they just come out of nowhere and it's all rather a bit odd. But I have been saying for the last maybe about 18 months that we are entering a new golden age of film. And if this doesn't somewhat point to it, put it like this. If I'm right and it's a whole decade now and it just gets better and better and peaks around the middle as it usually does, then tails off towards the end. That's usually how golden ages work. If that is the case, and I'm right, then this is like a touch paper moment for it sort of thing. Something when academics look back, when film study people look back, they will look at this moment as being something. Because the reason you can look at this moment simply is because in 92 years previously, this had never happened. So it's not as if you can say, well, look, it's like this. Or it's like, this has literally never happened. You also got a sense of like... how under pressure the Oscars were from that evening. Like, they're so under pressure. Like, if you just watch the Independent Spirit Awards, go watch that and look at the nominees for that the night before, and you'll get a sense of where we're going with film. The Oscars give you no sense of anything anymore. It's really fascinating how out of touch they are. But if you look at the Independent Spirit Awards, you'll get a genuine sense of where we're going. Things like Waves, Loose, Uncut Gems, all nominated multiple times. Sandler's phenomenal acceptance speech. Look at that compared to so many other acceptance speeches. How natural he is, how himself he is. Anyway, there you go. But yeah, it was a historic night, and it was a quite wonderful decision, in my opinion. For me, the best two movies of the year were that and Uncut Gems. Uncut Gems totally passed over for the Oscars, which is a disgrace. But there you go. It just gives it that, I think, that edge of being even more memorable now in a way, because it's a film that can be discovered over time, and that's a beautiful thing. Okay, right, so that's a long opening monologue for me. Quick break, and I'll be back to talk about Underwater first. Okay, right, so Underwater, Kristen Stewart's new starring vehicle, also got John Gallagher Jr. in it, it's got Vincent Cassell in it. This is a pursuit horror, I suppose, of sorts, under the water, in that what it is there's a mining company and they're like on the edge of this kind of trench. I think it has a name, to the Mariana Trench or something, and they're like digging around for resources, you know, as the world is obviously running out of resources. And then what happens is they just drill a hole, not dissimilar to the Meg in a way, they drill a hole where they shouldn't, and out of this hole comes like a Cthulhu type character. I don't know if it actually is Cthulhu, it might be. and then of course other monsters that it can give birth to and so forth that comes and destroys the part of the base they're in, kills the majority of people. There's a handful of survivors that have managed to isolate themselves, and then their only option to get to escape pods, because obviously you can't just go outside in a suit and swim to the surface, you're too deep, you're like 8 miles down. So their only option is to walk across open water, in a sense, in suits obviously, to another part of, like, I think it's like a new part of the drill or something like that, where they hope that the pods there aren't damaged, because the earthquake that struck has damaged this part of, like, another mining, mining station, I suppose, or what the hell you call it, underwater station or whatever the hell it's called. And then of course that's it, and then they walk across, and then as they walk across they confront other problems, more problems, until the end, where, you know, there's a not dissimilar to Alien, which is a film that it references very, very much, is like it's them or the aliens, if you like, or the monsters. I don't know what to say. Like, the biggest upset for me about the film is that this is not the right movie for Kristen Stewart. She's a fine actress. Her French output will prove that, like Clouds of Sils Maria and Personal Shopper, she's great in both. She's, I think, an excellent actress, and this is not the movie for her. She's just not right for it. She doesn't look comfortable in the movie. I don't think she quite knows what she's doing either, in it, to be quite honest. And then you've got someone like John Gallagher Jr., who's an excellent actor. He's the guy, he's from Newsroom, he's the evil guy in Hush, Short Term 12. He's a very multifaceted actor. And in this, he doesn't have anything to do for some reason. I think he's even in like a coma or something for a part of it. It makes no sense to me at all. What you have here is Alien welded together with the Abyss, welded together with Pitch Black. In that, you know, like within Pitch Black, when they're having to walk through the darkness to get to the dropship and so forth, it's pretty much exactly the same. There's just elements from all those films, all, as I say, welded together or melded together, if you like, making a new movie that is just utterly derivative. Now, granted, had you not seen all these films, then you might find something, you know, quite exciting in this film, thinking like, oh, this is, you know, that I haven't seen this before. But when you have seen all those films and you are my age, this is not exciting and it's not interesting to watch, I'm afraid. This reminds me very much of a film that came out two or three years ago called Life. And in that, there's a crew on a space station just off of Earth, and it's got Gyllenhaal and Ryan Reynolds is in it. And they've found this kind of organism, and of course they also want to bring it to Earth first. They're going to test it up there to see what it is. It gets loose, it gets out, it's hostile, and then just works its way, you know, through the space station and the crew. Just as that was a recalling of Alien, but with, like, you know, a gelatinous type of foe, if you like. This is exactly the same, but underwater, like even in the Abyss. Hang on, I'm going to take a quick drink of water. Even in the Abyss, there's this sense of they drill so deep, or they go so down under the water, that they find, you know, extraterrestrial life, but it's peaceful extraterrestrial life. In this, it's not peaceful. It's very hostile, but the whole notion of it is the same. And it just, like I say, it just is, you sit there and all I'm doing is pointing out, like, you know, or thinking to myself, well, this is from this, this isn't very interesting, the characters aren't particularly interesting, the one thing, though, at least it doesn't hang around too long. But the upsetting thing about it is that William Eubank, the guy who made it, like, made some fine independent movies like The Signal and Love. So I don't know if there was, like, you know, an element of having to concede things here, or having to have things done a certain way, because it's a bigger studio, it's like a bigger budget, 50 to 80 million, way bigger than he's dealt with before, so they might have been having to, like, you know, well, you can't have that, things have to be like this. I don't know, but it just doesn't make for a good movie. It just hasn't made for a good movie. If you come out, like, for me, it came out, like, and I will literally never think of that film again, other than talk about it if someone asks me about it, or do something like this. This is a movie that, in, like, Life, I didn't even remember. I had to look it up. I remember seeing Life. I remember going quite excited to go see it. I like stuff in space. It's just something that I enjoy. And I can just remember coming out of it thinking exactly the same as I do now. And I did not even remember the name of the film. The one reason that you might remember the name of this is it's called Underwater, and the film is Underwater, But yeah, I could not even remember what Life was called. I had to look it up. I had to look up Jake Gyllenhaal's movies and just scan through them until I found the one that looked like the one in space from a couple of years ago. It's a very anonymous movie, just as this is. They're highly derivative, highly anonymous, and yeah, it's just a big old meh if you're going to go see it in the cinema from me. But there you go. Make your own mind up, as always. Okay, quick break. I'll be back in a second. Okay, so let's get on to the new version of Emma. Of course, Jane Austen's great novel, probably the greatest romantic comedy drama novel ever, I imagine. I mean, it's just, it is timeless. There's no two ways about that. But for those who don't know, the last time this was tackled was very much in a glorious moment. It was in 1996, and it was a movie that did. I'm going to look and see if it's Yeah, it was like a $7 million budget, and it made like $25 million at the box office, which for like, you know, a costume driver is pretty damn good going. But it had, of course, the X factor of Gwyneth Paltrow, Alan Cumming, Toni Collette was in it, Ewan McGregor, Jeremy Northam. You know, but it just did. It came out at exactly the right moment, and it really did hit its straps. But it was very much the Paltrow era in that respect. You know, she just burst onto the scene. She was the new face of Hollywood at that time, and you know, Emma shot her to stardom, sort of thing. You know, this is pre her Oscar win with Shakespeare in Love and so forth, and this is the film that really did, like, you know, shoot her to the front of the line. Now, you know, now of course she's a global brand unto herself. But that was the film that launched, and of course then she had the, you know, she was with Pitt at the time, with Seven and so forth. But yeah, that really was a moment when that movie came out in terms of her being born as a superstar. So let's cut forward to 2020, and you know, it's the same, it's the same story. You won't be shocked to hear Emma Woodhouse, played this time by, let me get her name, Anna Taylor-Joy, who's a fine young actress in her own sense, but is already kind of already known way more than Paltrow was, I think. And she plays Emma Woodhouse, of course, the aristocrat who lives in a large mansion in Highbury and with her father, and can't leave. Her father's desperate for her not to leave after her sister left. And basically it's the world around them, and she is, you know, she's beautiful, she has a ridiculously sharp mind, and she's really, well, she thinks she is. She refuses to marry, but she thinks that she is a phenomenal matchmaker, and that is true. She has matched people, but then she gets it wrong with her friend Harriet Smith, or maybe she gets it right in terms of getting it wrong, if you like, and fails to see the wood for the trees, if you like, given how she's Woodhouse, where her own romantic leanings might be going as regards Mr. George Knightley, the rich gentleman played by Johnny Flynn, played wonderfully by Johnny Flynn, who lives nearby, but, you know, is very much a kind of, like, let's say he's not the normal gentleman. He walks everywhere. He has no problem with that. He doesn't take his carriage half the time. He allows other people to stay at his enormous mansion and so forth. And he just seems, for someone who is undoubtedly landed and is undoubtedly rich, he seems extremely well adjusted, let's put it like that. Unlike, of course, Frank Churchill, who is a little bit more of a cad. You know, what are you going to say? I mean, this is the absolute definition of timeless. That's it, of timelessness, if you like. It really is. The fact that this can just be remade, not dissimilar to Little Women, the fact that this can be remade practically every other decade, or turn up in some way, shape or form every other decade, be it on television or be it on stage or be it, you know, be it whatever, and still gather momentum, still bring people in, tells you that there's something about this story that is essentially, that will, you know, up until the end of humanity, this story is a story that will be read or told or watched or whatever it is. The cast is superb. You have Anna Taylor-Joy, like I said, and Johnny Flynn playing the two main roles. It's great to see him in a good movie. It really is. He is, of course, from he's from the Cineworld ads. For anybody who goes to the Cineworld as much as me, so before they had the ad that's running now, which I think is actually coming to an end now. So the recent ad has been the one, the Groundhog Day one. Before that, there was this kind of like this blonde kid in kind of walking through the different worlds of film. And that's Johnny Flynn. But for those who have seen him act, he was in Beast. He was in one of the best British films of the last decade. a film called Beast, which I don't think many people saw, sadly, with Jesse Buckley, and they were both like, Jesse Buckley is like too much, like she's too much, she's too talented, it's like annoying how talented she is. But and I made a big deal out of that, but Johnny Flynn was just as good, as he's so good in that movie, like he genuinely is so good. He's also a musician. He did the music for The Detectorist, the beautiful BBC show. He also appears in one episode singing the song, the title song. But it's just great to see him back in a movie, and he gives a wonderfully measured performance. But on top of that, you have Bill Nighy playing Mr. Woodhouse, like, perfectly. Mia Goth, who is sensational in it, as the last thing I saw her in, I thought was Cure for Wellness, which she was, like, you know, wonderfully odd in. She's wonderful as Harriet Smith. Miranda Hart, isn't it? Josh O'Connor, Callum Turner, Rupert Graves. What is the name of the girl? Hang on, I need to know what the name of the girl who plays... Is it Tanya Reynolds? I think it is. Tanya Reynolds turns up in it. Because I saw this and Greed back to back, and there's actors from Sex Education in both. There is also the absolutely sensational Connor Swindles is in it, who plays Adam Groff in Sex Education. If you haven't seen Sex Education, please go and see it. It's one of the best British shows in a long time. He plays Adam Groff in it, and I don't want to say too much if you haven't seen it, but basically he's a very tortured young man, and I can cry just looking at his face. And I'm not even exaggerating. He's so expressive with his face. He has so much pain as an actor in his face, playing that character in Sex Education. And this, he doesn't get a big role in this, sadly. He plays Robin, but again, he's playing that kind of male who is somewhat tortured. And Tanya Reynolds is in it as well. She plays the stunning Mrs. Elton, and she plays another kind of wonderfully bizarre character in Sex Education. She seems very tall. She has a very curious face to her. And from the minute she turns up, she pretty much steals every goddamn scene she's in. It's like, so what I'm trying to say is, from the top end of the character, the cast to the bottom, it's just stunning. And so it's directed by Autumn de Wilde, who I knew nothing about until I came out, because the minute, of course, the film finishes, the title card comes up as to who made it, and it's Autumn de Wilde. I was like, wow, what a great name for a director. And it has a very Wes Anderson feel, the film, without a doubt. A lot of title cards, the design, the pastels, you know, like the costume work in it is ridiculous. I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous how good the cinematography is. Fantastic, but the costume work, especially, which I know that you can say, well, you expect that. I mean, what do you expect? It's a costume drama, but still, it just looks so beautiful. But Autumn de Wilde is actually a photographer. This is her first film. She's American. And that makes sense. When you watch the composition of the shots, and you watch the composition of how the location work is superb, obviously. And you watch how the background is used as regards to the foreground with the actors. I mean, it does look in parts sometimes when they're walking through these like cavernous rooms. There's always like an element of Barry Lyndon to them. I'm not a big fan, I'll be honest, of costume dramas. It is something that I grew up heavily with, because in this country you just do. There's always some new big-end costume drama on television. But this, I mean, it's just funny. It's moving, it's touching. It's, you know, like I say, it's timeless. The story is timeless. As long as you put quality in the right roles, and the adaptation, the script adaptation is as sharp as the book is, and you have some level of decent photography, you're not going to struggle to make good of this work. That's it. And this doesn't either. Is it better than the Paltrow version, the 96 version? I don't know. I think it's just as good, personally. I think it might come down to when you've seen it. And if you saw Emma when you were like at that age, when she was breaking through, it probably is going to stay with you a bit more because of that. It was like, you know, it was a big release in that respect, in terms of making a what is now, like I said, a global superstar. But this is, as a movie, it's just as good. Emma, it's in the cinema now. I don't know what to say beyond that. You know, it's Jane Austen. What more can you say? There's a reason why it's still taught in schools and everybody knows the name of Jane Austen, like, you know, hundreds of years later. There's a reason why that is. Okay, right. Back in a second, and I'll be finishing up with a review of Michael Winterbottom's new movie, Greed. Okay, so here we go with Greed. Michael Winterbottom back with Steve Coogan again, of course. These are the guys that did The Trip together. They did Cock and Bull Story together. They've worked quite frequently together. And in this, basically what this is, it's a satire, a very black satire on the extreme wealthy. And it is centered around the billionaire high street fashion mogul. He is a billionaire high street fashion mogul who's having a 60th birthday on the Greek island of Mykonos. And his name is Sir Richard McCready. And of course, he is known as Sir Richard McGreedy. And there's no doubt, even from the title being Greed and not Green, that he is more or less entirely based on Sir Philip Green. There's no doubt about that. In that he made his money buying cheap clothes, selling them on the high street, like at ridiculously kind of like outpricing other known brands at the time, buying companies, bankrupting them, placing a great deal of debt on them, keeping that money for himself, and just going and going and going, just like he did with British Home Stores, all the way through to the Arcadia Group, which he owns now. And then, of course, you have the film goes between kind of three settings. There's the his past that we catch up with in different segments. There's the present, which is him in Mykonos putting together this like ridiculous party with like celebrity guests that he's having to pay to come there, and you know, celebrity music acts, and he's building like an amphitheater, kind of gladiator style amphitheater for some reason, like a spectacle. And it's just a sense of like, you know, and there are refugees on the beach there that he wants to get rid of because they're spoiling the look of his party and so forth. It's like a Roman toga party. And the him having to go before a select committee to talk about the collapse of one of his stores and his involvement in that. And over time, of course, we get to learn about his use of sweatshops, his how exactly. So basically, if you've seen Goodfellas, and in that, one of the ways they make money in that is they buy into bars and so forth. They then basically run up as much credit as possible at that venue, buying alcohol, cigarettes, anything they can get their hands on. They sell that on then as for any money, it doesn't matter. And then once, of course, you can't borrow anymore, once the creditors are imminent, they just burn the place down. That's it, for insurance. That's it. It's that simple. There's nothing really different to that, to what gangsters do, to what Philip Green does, in that what he does is he takes over other companies, other brands, not with his own money, with money that he's borrowed. He then he borrows as much money out of that company as is humanly possible, doesn't put it in his own name, obviously, and then, of course, ultimately bankrupts it, moves on, does it again, just with more money and more money and more money and more money. The film opens unbelievably with, like, him in, like, a celebratory kind of, like, meeting with his employees, where he's giving away, like, bonus checks. And of course, the biggest bonus check ever of $1.2 billion goes to his wife, or to himself. And of course, they're based in Monaco, so they pay no tax. But the person hosting the awards, unbelievably, because this was shot in 2018, is Carolyn Flack. Because there are like star cameos in the film. Stephen Fry's in it. James Blunt is in it. And yeah, it's very weird to see her at the beginning of the film. The film is dedicated to her death. Her shocking death. And it's just very weird because she would have been hired for something like that. Yeah, and I was saying she would have done it personally, but somebody like her would have been, because she's a big TV figure, she's known. So her being at an event like that, because that's the whole thing with his character, is that he understands that being flash is the way to do it, in that he grew up in the 80s, you know, in the Reagan-Thatcher eras, where it was okay to be like the loads of money character. There's a reason why the loads of money character was founded in that era. And he understands, just as Philip Green does, that, you know, being around celebrities, appearing flash, having big boats, you know, it will piss some people off, but it will give you that view that you are just massively successful. So Philip Green, of course, when he had Topshop, had, you know, Kate Moss do her own line there and so forth, kind of like taking over from Burberry, that kind of like feeling of what Burberry had been. Like, you know, I remember in the 2000s, like Topshop was absolutely the place to go. Like Topshop was huge. It was absolutely, it was hip and happening, and it was the place, especially for young women to go to buy clothes. There's absolutely no two ways about that. It worked in every which way. The film itself has got a great cast. You've got Coogan, David Mitchell, Isla Fisher plays his wife, who's not his wife, not sleeping with him, but is still his wife. Shirley Henderson does a wonderful job as his rather appalling mother. Asa Butterfield, again, the Sex Education connection, plays his highly disgruntled son, and so forth and so forth. David Mitchell has even talked in a recent interview with The Guardian that he felt very at home playing what he regarded to be, you know, a lily-livered pressman who is basically following Richard around, doing like a bullshit biography of him, essentially talking to people, everybody saying he's largely, you know, just an enormous piece of shit, and him having to cook that up in a way into being something really good. You also got his daughters appear when they're at the birthday party and so forth, and one of them, I think it's, is it Sophie Cookson who plays Lily McCready? I think it is. And she's like in some kind of like, you know, Jersey Shore type show at the same time. So that's going on at the same time. It's just the whole thing. There's moments of real magic in it, to say the least. But it doesn't quite come together. I feel like it just feels a little bit episodic with the going back and forth, the way the narrative works in it. It doesn't quite hit the right note a lot of the time. There's a lot of downtime in it, which doesn't help. And Coogan's talked about them not wanting to go too overboard with the bad behaviour. But it seems to me, given the fact that he's known for non-disclosure agreements, Philip Green is very, very much known for it, for appalling behaviour with his female staff. Like, why isn't that included? Like, you kind of want to see that Wolf of Wall Street type behaviour, you know, coming out of, you know, a British setting. I think that would have worked phenomenally well, personally. And I'm kind of surprised that isn't included, especially by Winterbottom, not a director known for, like, you know, for being scared of being controversial. I'm not too sure, like, what it is they're going for. In this, he gets his comeuppance, obviously. Philip Green hasn't had any level of comeuppance, really. Or maybe, you know, maybe he now can only afford, you know, a £500 million yacht and not a £1 billion yacht. I don't know. But there is that to it, I suppose. But yeah, it just feels like I enjoyed the disgustingness of it. Jess is just infuriated by the whole thing. Like, she's like David Mitchell. Like, you know, he was saying that he finds the notion of impending nuclear doom to be comforting, so that all this will end, all this disgustingness will end. And Jess, when she watches things like this, just gets angrier and angrier and angrier, whereas I kind of enjoy watching it. I kind of enjoy watching the depths of humanity, like what people will do to each other. There's something quite comforting about it for me, in that, you know, like, you know, as bad as I am in terms of being a poor person, like, I'm not like that. I wouldn't treat people like that. And so in that, I feel quite comforted, oddly enough. But yeah, it just doesn't, yeah, it just doesn't come together. It doesn't quite fire on all cylinders. Bits of it are great, in my opinion, like the celebrity bits, like he has lookalikes at the party, things, little touches like that, just to make, you know, so when people are taking pictures, it might look like these famous people are there. They just don't give a shit. It's all about the appearance. It's all about the idea of, like, these celebrities loving him and thinking he's a great guy, and that then filtering through to all the rags and so forth, you know, the cheap press then saying, like, you know, what a great guy he is, like, you know, look, he's had this amazing party. Apparently Philip Green had a party in was it the Maldives, I think, where, you know, like he flew in like a gigantic Buddha and then had like women topless, and all of this being very much against the natives kind of like belief system. They don't like anything like that. They don't have topless beaches there. They don't like people going topless. They don't believe, they're not people who believe in Buddha and so on. And so, but just not giving a shit, that's the thing. Just not, like, you know, like, he's building this amphitheater for God knows what reason, really. They have a real tiger there, which is involved in the comeuppance, and you know, he wants it to look like a real, even though it can't be a real amphitheater, it's made out of bloody plywood, for Christ's sake. But like all of this, and it's just almost as if he just wants to complain about something. There's one great line in it as regards Philip Green, where someone says about him, like, you know, he never gave a shit about the fashion industry. That's the thing. He just likes deals. Like, he just likes ripping people off. That's it. That's what he likes doing. He just happened to be that he landed in the garment industry. That's it. It had nothing to do with actual clothes. It's just that sense of, you know, of convincing people that they should sell to him at a ridiculously low price, and then the joy of having ripped them off for that money. That's all there is to him as a human being. I don't know. It's a hard film to recommend because it is a very brutally savage, dark, miserable experience watching it. But I still would recommend it, to be quite honest with you, because if you don't know about things like this, if you don't know about this type of behaviour, then you should. You really, really should. And you should get angry about it. You really should. Okay, Greed. It's in the cinema now. I would not expect it to be there for too long, to be quite honest with you. I can't see this being a heavily attended movie. So if you want to go and see it, go see it sooner rather than later. Okay, quick break and I'll be back to wrap everything up as usual. Okay, thank you to anybody who listens to this podcast, shares this podcast, tells anyone about this podcast, goes to my website, alexcohen.com, interacts with me. I'm going to be starting a new thing on Instagram, I think. I'm only just announcing this now. I'm going to start a new thing which will be interesting for me. I'm not going to say what it is yet. Maybe I'll talk about it over the next few weeks, but I am going to actually start something, having not done Instagram for a long time now, but it still is the only social media platform that I in any way can tolerate. So, yeah, I think I've come up with an idea, so I will expound on this over the weeks to come. I even watched a movie yesterday that would pay into it, but I'll expand on this as we get into it. So I'll be back in a week or so where I'll be talking about three new films, and they are. I'll be talking about The Colour Out of Space, which is exciting because it is Richard Stanley's return to the cinema, which is long overdue and is genuinely a... You know, again, for me, it's a point to, and if it's true that he has signed a three-picture deal to adapt three Lovecraft movies, and I'll get into that in the review probably, then we're going to get two more as this decade rolls on, which for me is another pointer to this decade being an interesting decade in film. So I'll be talking about that. I'll be talking about Onwards, the new Pixar movie, and I will be talking about a film that I'm really looking forward to. Probably the film the first 2020 film that I've been genuinely excited about, and that is Lee Whannell's The Invisible Man. It looks like it's a hybrid It looks from the trailer that it is a hybrid of the original 30s version and Verhoeven's Hollow Man, which I really rate. I understand it has endless problems, but I think that film is way better than people make out it is. But I love Paul, and hence why my entire arm is covered in tattoos by him, by his movies anyway. And I just love the sadism of that film. I just think it's such a sadistically dark film, and it seems that this has taken the best elements of both to make a brand new movie, and it's Elizabeth Moss. I am supremely excited about it. I have to say that I am, and I really hope it delivers. Okay, I'll be back then. Until then, please take care of yourselves, take care of everybody else in your lives. Remember to tell people how you feel about them. It's incredibly important. Not only is it important for them, but it's important for you to be that person. Everybody wants to be that person. It's not easy being that person. Okay, right. Until then, take care. Watch as much stuff as you can, and we will reconvene in a week or so. Bye till then.